I have a funny feeling
Today is February 20th, 2017. This is Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Good morning, everyone. Today is a continuation of the public hearing on House Bill 5026, the Health Policy and Analytics section. I thought that it would be appropriate this morning to take note of Representative Hayden's haircut. It looks fantastic. I appreciate people looking sharp for committee. We'll go ahead and turn it over to Director Clements and Director Saxon to continue the presentation.
Good morning, Co-Chair, members of the committee. My name is Leslie Clement, Director of Health Policy and Analytics. This morning, I have Susan Otter joining us, and Susan's going to take us through the Office of Health Information Technology slides, the presentation there. That office is the only one that has a POP. It's a fee POP, and we'll ask Susan to describe that as well. Director Lynn Saxon is here this morning, and after Susan completes her review of the IT portion of the presentation, Director Saxon will help walk us through the behavioral health issues and specifically the collaborative. I'm going to take 2 seconds, probably, to review this one slide. This is our Office of Health Analytics. So I've to take you back to Friday, we went through all the offices within Health Policy and Analytics Division. This office in particular is kind of where all of our data experts reside. They are responsible for administrative data, so requests about how many people are eligible in the program, how many people are using services, what services are they using, what's the trend. They work with the forecasting office. They work with the Medicaid management information system, the eligibility system. They pull all that data from various sources to hopefully provide a picture of what's going on here in Oregon. They're also responsible for managing metrics. So they're the staff that manages the CCO metrics work and work with the committee, and will work with the future committee that's Senate Bill 440. They also do a lot of economic impact analysis. They work on things like the hospital financial report, and I think you've recently probably been inundated by a number of reports that came out of their office. They staff the legislative quarterly report. We just initiated that in the last 6 months, so we've received 2 reports to date. And let's say they also do survey work too. So they did they manage the Oregon Health Insurance Survey. They're also the people that I go to when we see a study out there that ranks Oregon in some position. And I go to them and I say, you know, is this a valid, reliable study? Will you do the assessment? So they're a great team, great resource to us, and I'll be glad to answer any questions about that. Okay. Susan, will you take us away? Oh, this is just a example of one of the key performance metrics. It is about our emergency room department use statewide. It is an incentive metric for the CCOs.
Co-Chair Rehfield, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Susan Otter, and I'm the Director of Health Information Technology for the Oregon Health Authority. The Office of Health Information Technology supports the right health information technology infrastructure and tools to support our health system transformation goals through health IT policies, programs, and partnerships. I wanted to highlight 3 things that from 2016 that I wanted to bring to your attention and then talk about some of the work we have underway. One of the things we do is support electronic health record adoption in Oregon. So it's critical that our hospitals and providers use certified electronic health records that meet federal requirements and standards for interoperability and effectiveness. We're fortunate that we're able to bring federal incentive payments to hospitals and providers in Oregon through the Medicaid Electronic Health Record Incentive Program. And this is this program has been in effect since 2011, and we've brought in 2016 alone more than $21 million and 100% federal funds to 18 hospitals and more than 1,200 providers. Over the life of the program, Oregon hospitals and providers have received more than $440 million in federal incentive payments, either through the Medicaid incentive program that we operate or through the Medicare incentive program. And those $440 million in incentive payments have come to all 61 Oregon hospitals and more than 7,600 Oregon eligible professionals. One of the other main things that we support in the Office of Health Information Technology is sharing health information across different organizations. Health information exchange is critical to support care coordination, the integration of physical, oral, and behavioral health, and the movement of health information for data analysis and to support alternative payment models. One of the most exciting things that we've done in health information exchange is supporting the Emergency Department Information Exchange, or EDI, in Oregon. EDI connects all of the Oregon hospitals to data to the Washington hospital data for events. So these are hospital event data, admits, discharges, and transfers. So all Oregon hospitals have been live in contributing their data to EDI since the early 2015. And then they're receiving alerts back from the EDI system when someone arrives at their emergency room that's been a high utilizer of emergency department services. Those alerts give them critical information about where a patient has been seen for what issues and at what time, and care guidelines from other users of the system to give critical high-level information to the emergency room physicians and team about how to manage that person's care. Things like whether a person is on a pain contract and has particular opioid prescribing guidelines that they've agreed to abide by. Pre-Manage is a complementary tool that sits on top of the EDI database and is used by our CCOs, health plans, and clinics to access that same information about hospital events for their patients or members. Pre-Manage provides real-time notifications back to the care team when their patient or member has a hospital event and allows our primary care homes, our behavioral health homes, our CCOs and health plans to better manage their populations. This has been one of the most exciting things in health IT in Oregon that I've been able to be a part of, and we're really thrilled to co-sponsor EDI as the Oregon Health Authority in partnership with the Oregon Health Leadership Council and others.
Yeah, Rep. Alonso Leal.
Thank you. In respect to EDI, is this something that people sign up for, or is this or opt in or opt out for?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Alonso Leal, the EDI is not an opt in. Patients can opt out if they choose at the hospital. To having their information included. The emergency room situation for patients, their information can be shared in an emergency regardless of their opt-in or opt-out status. But when it comes to sharing information back with the health plans or the clinics, patients do have the opportunity to opt out at the hospital.
Thank you.
I have a little map I'll show you on the next slide about our spread of EDI and pre-manage, but I wanted to mention one other thing. In 2016, we were well underway with a federal grant to support regional health information exchange, as well as removing barriers to behavioral health information sharing. So now in 2017, we're in the last year of this two-year grant that's brought more than $2 million to Oregon. Our subrecipient is Reliance eHealth Collaborative, which used to be called Jefferson Health Information Exchange. They've just changed their name. Reliance eHealth Collaborative is a regional health information exchange supported by the hospitals and CCOs in their regions. They're in Southern, Central, and the Gorge area in Oregon. and have interest in potentially moving into other areas as their value is being known. We have a couple of other regional health information exchanges. Reliance is the largest. So Reliance provides referrals and a community health record that brings in information from hospitals, labs, outpatient specialists into one record for the treating team to access as they're working with our patients. So we're thrilled that we're able to bring federal funds into Oregon to support an initiative that this HIE is using to manage the consents around substance use treatment data. So 42 CFR Part 2, which is a federal regulation, requires that patients receiving substance use treatment actively consent to their substance use treatment data being shared. This is an important protection because of the stigma related to substance use treatment. However, it becomes a real barrier to effective sharing of health information across teams that need to know. What's been especially challenging is how to manage those discrete consents electronically. So what we've been able to do is use these grant funds to help the Reliance eHealth Collaborative develop first a common interpretation of 42 CFR Part 2, and then a common consent model and form that can be used across the board. And then they're implementing that consent model electronically within their technology. So it's very exciting. We have a number of large behavioral health organizations that will be participating electronically now for the first time and sharing their information appropriately with the right consents. So I just wanted to share with you, this is the map of our CCOs in Oregon that have adopted pre-manage as a tool to help them manage their populations at risk for hospitalization. We have 14 CCOs that have adopted or are in process of adopting pre-manage. Let's see, so we have 10 that are live with pre-manage, several of which have been live since the beginning, and are super users of pre-manage. It's really changed the way their coordinated care teams have worked with populations that are at risk for high utilization of emergency room services. So the you can see in the south, In Southern Oregon, our four CCOs in that area are in process of launching their subscriptions. They should be live shortly. We also are supporting assertive community treatment teams with their own subscription to pre-manage. These are teams that are critical for wrapping around individuals with severe psychiatric issues who are at risk for institutionalization. And it's critical that those teams have immediate real-time information about when their client is in the hospital. OHA is supporting a Medicaid subscription to pre-manage. That means we're covering with federal funds and state funds the costs for 2 years for our CCOs, our ACT teams, our we're also piloting with our aging and persons with disabilities, field offices around their long-term care placements, as a pilot to understand how can this pre-managed tool help ensure that our Medicaid patients receive the care that they need and that they don't fall through the gaps. Any questions on pre-manage or Eddie? I forgot to mention also that our CCOs and commercial health plans are sponsoring subscriptions to pre-manage for their key clinics. So we have over 200 clinics that are using pre-manage. These are patient-centered primary care homes, community mental health programs, and dental programs and others that are using pre-manage as a tool to help them manage their own patients. Those teams are able to actually enter information, care guidelines that the emergency room can see to help them manage their patients and refer them back to their care coordinator or their provider. Wanted to come back.
Actually, Representative Bueller.
Yeah, I just want to thank you for the great work on Eddie. I hear almost daily from ER physicians specifically about how impactful it is on just their daily work in patient care. So that's a job well done.
Thank you. I wanted to highlight our electronic health record adoption across our CCO providers. This is, again, one of our main metrics. We have topped out on our electronic health record adoption metric for our CCOs. So our CCO providers have exceeded the benchmark of 72% that we set for 2015. And so we're going to continue to monitor the adoption of certified electronic health records by our CCO providers as we go, but we're pleased to see the drastic increase in adoption across their provider networks. So I want to talk about a couple of our projects, and then we'll go back to the slides on Behavioral Health Collaborative for the next part. So we are working on implementing three major programs in 2017 and 2018, our Oregon Common Credentialing Program, our statewide provider directory, and our clinical quality metrics registry. I'll talk about the first two on the next slide, but I wanted to mention the clinical quality metrics registry is an effort to efficiently and effectively collect the clinical metrics data that we need to support our CCO incentives, as well as for providers to meet meaningful use. For example, as we hold our CCOs accountable to achieving the health outcomes we want them to achieve, we collect data on diabetes, poor control, hypertension, depression screening and follow-up, and soon tobacco cessation that come from electronic health records for their key primary care clinics. Those electronic clinical data are critical to helping understand whether we're achieving outcomes in addition to the process measures that we're measuring. Those electronic health records can be challenging to get those discrete clinical data out effectively, and we're leveraging standards that are inherent into the certification of electronic health records to enable more efficient collection of that data. The registry will enable providers to report their data to our registry directly and have that reporting count for multiple programs that those providers are responsible for. So in addition to our CCO incentive metrics, providers must report to meet their federal EHR incentive program incentive payments through meaningful use. So we'll have our Medicaid providers report those data to our registry to meet that program as well. Under Medicare, the meaningful use program is transitioning under MACRA, and the reporting under the MACRA MIPS program includes clinical metrics as well. So those providers will be able to report efficiently in one place to have aligned reporting on their behalf if they so choose.
Explain the acronyms.
MACRA is the Medicare Access, MIPS is the Merit-Based Incentive Payment System, and that is the, for Medicare, CMS is combining multiple different value-based payment systems, the Physician Quality Reporting System, the Meaningful Use Reporting under the Medicare EHR Incentive Program, and the value-based modifier reporting, so that those clinical metrics reporting programs under Medicare will now be combined in one under the merit-based incentive payment system.
Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair. So we're going to get rid of some acronyms, hopefully. The data with regards to health outcomes that's collected by CCOs, how difficult is that to drill down to the individual level if needed?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Bueller, the CCOs have been reporting aggregate data at the provider or clinic level. We're testing patient-level data in their submission that's due in April for last year. So we're moving towards patient-level reporting. It is challenging. It depends on the electronic health record and the sophistication of the clinic in being able to report that data effectively. Our metrics align with the meaningful use metrics that are built into their electronic health records in almost all cases, and so that makes that reporting more effective. In the standards for certified electronic health records, there is a standard related to individual level reporting for those clinical metrics data, and that standard is improving, but it has not been as reliable as our providers would have hoped until it needs to improve a little bit more.
Senator Winters.
Just following the question, and and moving towards reliability, what do you see that some of the corrections are, what needs to be done and to make it more reliable?
Co-chair Rayfield, Senator Winters, we're patient-centered primary care homes and other clinics need support with the technology that they have to most effectively use that technology, including the reporting components. So in some cases, we have very sophisticated organizations that are able to reliably report that information and effectively report it. In some cases, we have much smaller organizations. A couple things are critical to having the information be reliable. One is ensuring that the information is put in a way that's captured in the right fields, so to speak, within the electronic health record. So that's really the workflow that the providers use when they're charting.
Because the field has changed dramatically since the days I was in record, where you relied on the nomenclature and you manually actually recorded everything. So that, to me, would probably be the biggest challenges out there in, among your smaller group.
Yeah, Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Winters, there are standard nomenclatures that are used. Certain fields and things are more standard than others. So when you have a diabetes A1C level that's a lab value, that may be much more reliable than, for example, the depression screening and follow-up, which is can be recorded in a number of different places in a number of different ways, or the hypertension measure. So we're trying to rely on measures that have some standard, you know, some confidence to that, to those standards, and then to support providers with technical assistance and guidance to help them as they work to ensure their data are quality when they put them in. So I wanted to finish by talking about our two provider data related programs that we are working to implement. This also relates to our policy option package, which is a fee pop that you'll be hearing more about later in the session. So we have two programs. One is the Oregon Common Credentialing Program. This was legislatively mandated by Senate Bill 604 in 2013 to support the centralization of collecting standard credentialing information for all credentialed practitioners. The program is a mandated program. It's mandated that practitioners will enter their common their credentialing information and submit their primary source documents into our database and program, and that credentialing organizations such as health plans, hospitals, ambulatory surgical centers, and others will be required to use the information in the centralized program as they make their credentialing assessments and decisions. This is really an effort to reduce practitioner burden. Right now, practitioners fill out a common application. We've standardized across the application, and they submit that and their primary source documentation to every health plan or hospital or ambulatory surgical center that they are contracted with. And this can result in numerous delays in incomplete applications where credentialing organizations need to follow up one at a time, and significant duplication. So we're excited about bringing this program to Oregon, and the program I wanted to mention is also intended to be fee-funded, and so you'll see in our POP, and later in probably around April, we'll come back to you with some more details about the fee component as well.
Senator Ward, did you have a question?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm just listening intently.
Okay. Very good, very good. Please continue.
And the, so we have about 55,000 Oregon practitioners that are expected to be participating in over 300 credentialing organizations.
Yes, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Co-Chair Rayfield. Will that concept lead to some sort of uniformity between the hospitals, the organizations, on what they accept as far as credentialing within their networks? Because there's quite a variety or variance between what one organization or one CCO will accept as credentialing and another accepts something else as credentialing, and they got this other requirement, and if he wants to go work in a different hospital, he's got to do a whole different. Is that going to bring some uniformity to that, or is it just the paperwork and then all the entities engage with it separately?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Hayden, yes and no. So we have a common application that all credentialing organizations are required to use now, and that's a paper application. Credentialing organizations can choose to request additional information directly from those credential practitioners. In some cases, hospitals or others may have more detailed history that they want, or they want additional information that's not included in that common application. The application and the credentialing program really go back to the accrediting entity standards for credentialing. Hospitals, health plans, et cetera, are accredited, and they must meet those accrediting entity standards. So our common credentialing program will meet all of those standards. We also go through a public process to update the common credentialing application, which we do every year. What I think we'll find is as we have hospitals, health plans, and others that are mandated to use the common credentialing program, I think we will be encouraging folks to align to that, to reduce and to see the value of the efficiencies of having the information centralized. We're partnering with the Health Leadership Council, the Hospital Association, and others to really work with stakeholders to ensure that this program will be efficient and effective. In the end, health plans and hospitals and others will need to make business decisions about that they need to be comfortable with about their any additional expectations or requirements they have for their credentialing processes. Okay. The last thing I wanted to mention is our statewide provider directory. This program will provide healthcare organizations, state and local programs with an accurate and comprehensive directory of providers in Oregon. This will leverage the validated data from the credentialing program. In the credentialing program, we'll have primary source validation and verification of that information. The provider directory data is sort of a thin layer of what you get out of credentialing, so information about where a provider is practicing and what their affiliations are, what their license and specialty are, and how to contact them will be supported in the provider directory, as well as information about health information exchange, how to electronically send records or referrals to that provider. We'll add to the credentialing data for practitioners that are not credentialed and also include facility-level information that we have, such as patient-centered primary care home tier and other information that a health plan, a CCO, or others may need to know about the providers or clinics that they contract with. It'll be a voluntary program. We're funding this program largely with 90% federal matching funds and 10% state funds. This will be of great use in our Medicaid program. We expect to charge nominal fees for users that are not Medicaid-specific users, such as commercial health plans, once we've launched the program. So we'll have a small amount of our fee pop will include fees related to the non-Medicaid users.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. It's important. I'm Lynn Saxton. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Authority. That's the first time I've remembered to do that, so I'm full of pride. I do think it's important to just take a brief minute here and say that the professional talent at the Oregon Health Authority in our analytics team is truly exceptional. Director Clement in the last 2 years has executed no fewer than 4 major initiatives entirely not on her work plan, delivered those products or those policy initiatives on time in budget and at a level of professionalism that would be exceptional in the private or the public sector. Susan is ferocious in her talent for this work and in her commitment to this work. People have, for the last 2 years, pulled me out into hallways and said, "That's Susan Otter," and I've said, "She's not available." And that is principally due to her commitment to this really critical work that we are doing in Oregon to advance healthcare for all Oregonians. And so I just want to call out both of their work at this opportunity because having returned from a week in Washington, D.C., part of what I have seen is why Oregon is succeeding in ways that other states are truly struggling with, and this is part of it, is that solid analytical foundation base. So I want to personally thank them and commend them to your consideration for outstanding service to the state. Let's talk about the Behavioral Health Collaborative. We're very excited about this. I do want to say I have a meeting with our tribal partners, an official consultation this week with the nine federally recognized tribes in Oregon. The tribes have a very distinct interest in behavioral health and behavioral health services and ensuring that the tribes are able to advance the level of care that they're hoping to advance. So until I complete that consult, that formal consultation with them, which I believe is most of the day on Thursday.
Tomorrow.
Oh, thank you. I'll be ready. The I can't go out of respect for that relationship and their sovereignty. I can't go into complete detail, but I can talk to you about what we're doing now in the immediate term with regard to behavioral health, and also talk to you about how the Behavioral Health Collaborative fits in. Obviously, when we convened the collaborative in July, we had some priorities. And part of the framework that I like to use for this work is the notion of a 21st century behavioral health system. I find myself often thinking about how we are now in the 21st century, and we need to use the tools we have available to us to truly deliver results in a best practice, forward-thinking way, as opposed to what we have done, for example, since the 1960s. And so we set out as our priorities the principal concern of improving behavioral health outcomes for consumers. This speaks to Representative Buehler's concern that we'd be able to look at patient-level data as opposed to number of treatment sessions held, et cetera. We really need to focus on the behavioral health population itself and what that population needs. That work began last year with the creation of the behavioral health map in Oregon. That work has progressed significantly in the last 2 years, particularly as we joined with the Farley Center at University of Colorado to specifically look at what are the needs of Oregonians by age group, by need, by service, by funding, all across the state. So that was our first priority. Our second was to improve equitable access to effective services in every part of the state. One of the first takeaways when we looked at the map we developed on our own data was that there were parts of the state where there simply were not sufficient services for various groups, whether it was young children or a growing concern in Oregon, senior citizens with serious behavioral health issues. So part of what we have charged the collaborative with and will be expanding on as their report moves forward is making sure there is equitable access for everyone. That includes a discussion that we've already had with the U.S. Department of Justice and others about the importance of having the appropriate services in rural Oregon, which may need to look very different from the services that are available in major metropolitan areas. I had the experience probably 8 years ago now of starting a foster care program on the Oregon coast, and that was much needed. And the QMHPs we needed, we simply, with aggressive hiring, with relentless effort, we simply could not ever get the critical mass we needed to build Medicaid for some of those services on the coast. And so we need to look at that not as an insolvable problem, but one that we need to bring our professional expertise to solving, whether it involves getting waivers with CMS, innovative program models, et cetera, but we simply can't leave those areas unserved. And finally, we need to improve efficiency and cost effectiveness in services. And often when I talk about this, people get very anxious in the behavioral health community because there's a broad sense right now that the system is largely underfunded. And so part of what we have focused on here is getting the data to identify what are we currently funding? Is it best practice? Are the patient-level outcomes significant? And are there alternatives or solutions that Oregon has not implemented and should be looking at? And that includes, as I often discuss with my friend Chris Bonaf, the head of executive director of NAMI, is we need to look at the dollar amount we need to spend, where we spend it, how we spend it, not just an abstract concept of more money is needed. So that work is underway as well. Obviously, the challenges we face are resource constraints and really developing in a timely manner alternatives to institutional services. And so the collaborative was tasked with really thinking about how do we get to that solution, which has been elusive for Oregon. The U.S. Department of Justice, as I told you a week ago, has a very rigorous schedule for Oregon to begin to develop non-institutional services for people, and we're going to hold ourselves accountable to getting that done. Finally, we need to develop strategies to integrate behavioral health into the coordinated care model and the CCO model. I want to commend a number of CCOs are hard at this work already. I shared with you previously some of their successes, but there is a lot of work left to do to make sure that we have behavioral health integrated into that physical health, oral health model. And I want to underscore oral health often falls aside in that conversation. It is really critical to this conversation, just like physical health. We hope to begin implementing the behavioral health collaborative recommendations in the new biennium and achieve targets in the U.S. Department of Justice performance plan. Thank you. The collaborative was an application process, and we worked very hard to have members representing counties, the CCOs, consumers, tribal health care, mental health and addiction providers, prevention, education, corrections, and public safety. We really are committed, and they were very hardworking in integrating solutions in behavioral health, not in silos of physical health or medical health care, but actually understanding the interplay between the judicial system, the very critical interplay with our schools, and I think we had real gains over those 7 months, particularly because people were working in task forces and had to really work with people they may not work with on a daily basis and think about these challenges differently. You see there a list of the Behavioral Health Collaborative members. We'd be happy to give you a list of their names. I want to thank them for their hard work. It was not an easy ride. We had some false starts and we had some restarts, but at the end of the day, everyone leaned into the work, and as you'll see when you see their report, produced, I think, a very high-quality outcome. Particularly, I want to salute the collaborative for working on a very tight timeline. We were very focused on having them get something that will be available and useful to you in this session. We are very intent at the agency and not just doing the things we're doing right now to make behavioral health better, but to really drive hard to kind of shift the focus to one of results as opposed to episodes of care in the near future.
Yes, Senator Gilzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for coming back today, Lynn. So one of the concerns that I've heard from consumers that participated on the collaborative and out in the field is that while they appreciated being there, they didn't feel like the final product reflected the concerns of consumers and are concerned that there is not a budgetary or policy commitment to peer services. So even this morning, I heard from someone that is dismantling some peer services in a part of the state because the funding is no longer available to serve those individuals. Can you speak to that and talk about where we could find the health authority's commitment to peer services, where that's showing up in the budget, and how consumers can better feel heard?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Gelser, I'd certainly be interested in the specifics of after this meeting of sure. Where and when and how. Let me step back a minute. There were a number of concerns at the beginning of the collaborative about would we be sure to encompass trauma-informed care? Would we be sure to encompass peer-delivered services. There's a number of elements of a successful behavioral health system that we're very committed to and we need to include in the go-forward model. That being said, what we resisted, if you will, or perhaps that's too strong a word, what we wanted to start with is what is the result we want for the funds we're using and the funds we may want to additionally get, and let's work back from that result as opposed to creating a list at the outset of all the things we need to include that may or may not produce a result that's desirable. And particularly in this integration with the CCO model and the coordinated care model, what is the structure or the governance model we use to get those elements of a successful system considered effectively? So, for example, peer-delivered services, first of all, are very effective in serving people over the course of care. We view them as critical to the ongoing success of a behavioral health system. However, they are an element that needs to be integrated with many other elements, and part of what the health authority is trying to create is a situation or a process where the functional deliverers of healthcare services collaborate to produce a model of care that is successful, and then we ensure that that model is appropriately funded and produces the results we need. So what I think we did not do is we did not say, here's the budget and we're going to allocate it to these resources. What we did say is, here is the framework for using the budget to make good mental health decisions. And that includes, of course, peer support services. So I think the sense or the assumption that it was not addressed may be premature because we're not that far in the process yet. And I think that what we wanted to do is create a process that allows the various needs of the mental health system to come to the table and produce a recommendation that is holistic, but also not just responding to in a whole series of elements that could create a behavioral health system. Let me see if I can say that a little better. When I was in Washington, D.C. last week, one of the interesting experiences I had is lots of conversations with people who are not thinking about a health system. They're thinking about elements of things you can do. And what we've done in Oregon is we've said, that's inefficient, it's ineffective, and we're not going to do it that way anymore. In physical health, we got very granular about that years ago. We didn't get granular about it in behavioral health. We kind of said we want visits 7 days after you leave a hospital. We left it kind of vague. The step we need to take now is to say, here's the data about this region. Here's the money for this region. Let's take that data and that money and drive to a different place. And in some regions where, for example, in fact, I would say in all regions, you're going to have a level of peer support services. Do we want to, at this stage, prescribe what that level should be? No, because if we do that, we're going to foreclose something else that needs to be considered in a robust, data-driven conversation. So in my tenure at the agency, I have been pushing back hard on just funding something for behavioral health, because I am most interested in funding a result, which will require trauma-informed care, peer-delivered services, different SUD interventions, perhaps, than we're currently using. And what we're going to set in motion is the analytical framework to make those choices. So I think we do embrace peer-delivered services. I've had direct experience with the success of peer-delivered services for adolescents. It has to be part of the go-forward portfolio. Have we decided how much, where, and when, and a distinct funding stream in our budget? No, we have not, because there's an analytical step that has to take place first, or we're effectively going to have just a mental health services that funds some stuff, and we hope it works out well for people. And I'm not referring to peer-delivered services as stuff. I'm saying you can fund a bunch of elements and you cannot produce a good result. We're starting with the result, the money, and the analytics, and then we'll build the system that will produce that result.
Thank you. And I have a follow-up?
Please.
Just slightly different direction. So the collaborative finished its work. It has its recommendations that have come out. We have our bill dropping deadline on the 28th. I know, sorry, that cold. I know the policy committee has the agency's basically placeholder bill related to behavioral health. At what point do you expect there will be statutory recommendations or requests for language? Is that coming, or do you have the authority and capacity to respond to all of the recommendations of the collaborative without any statutory change?
The Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Gelser, one of the pieces of work we did in the collaborative is kind of a deep dive on what our current capacity is with our separate statutory authority for community mental health programs and CCOs, and a large amount of the proposals we hope you will see in the Behavioral Health Collaborative's report can be done under current law and statute and rule. There may be a list of changes and adjustments we will make, but they are we have a lot of bandwidth currently to implement a better program for behavioral health in Oregon.
Thank you. And one final follow-up.
Please.
Thank you. Again, yet another direction. I know in talking with a number of the folks that engaged in the collaborative and people around the state, one of the issues that's emerging is the role that privately covered services play in our behavioral health system across the state, where the barrier actually may be higher for individuals that are covered by private insurance than those that may be able to access services through the CCO.
Yes.
Did the Behavioral Health Collaborative have conversations about whether we actually have in Oregon mental health parity and whether the current statutory framework is enough to enforce protection for consumers and patients to access the care they need at the time that they need it, in the place that they need it, and for the duration of time that they need it? Or is that something that we need to be looking at? Because when people can't get in through that private coverage door, even though that isn't necessarily within your authority at the health authority, those individuals land in your responsibility when they come in the door through a crisis through the county mental health system, through the jail, through the state hospital. So is that part of the discussion? Do you have recommendations about that? And how can we get private insurance to the table to really be helping people?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Gelser, we had discussions about that. My first exposure to that issue was in 2002, and I think the health authority has a very clear interest in this issue because where there are gaps in commercial coverage, those patients, members, go on to Medicaid because they can't get what they need, particularly in the children's system, as we both know. So I think we had discussions. We will have recommendations. The mental health parity discussion is live. And I think actually in the proposals you will see the team, the 50-member collaborative, was very sensitive to that issue and has some, I think, some creative ideas on how we move forward.
And will those recommendations be coming forward soon? It makes me nervous to wait another 2 years if we do need statutory assistance to help bring our commercial insurers along to address the mental health crisis that we're having in the state. And time is short. And how I'm interested in how we both in this committee and in the policy committee can make sure that conversation is at the top of the queue list so that we are making change fast.
Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Gelser, my hope is the collaborative's recommendations will be available in March.
And that's late for this session.
Pardon me?
That's very late for this session. Is there any way to hurry that up to like last week?
So a couple things. Actually, given that we have a lot of authority that, in my mind, we're not using effectively right now, the health authority itself, I think we will be, as I mentioned previously, we'll be able to address many of these things under existing statutory and regulatory authority. Remember, we have two large pockets of authority, not just the CCOs, but the community mental health programs as well. I think we will have recommendations in a timely manner and an action plan for beginning to implement those recommendations. It is critical that we go through this process of the sovereign consultation with the tribes. We'll begin that this week. They have specifically asked that we not release the collaborative report until we've had a thorough consultation with them, and I think we can do that. I also think we have a very reasonable approach for the tribes to help their issues get full resolution and addressing. What people are very concerned about in the behavioral health world, understandably, with any change, is that a perhaps fragile system not get more fragile by money going in a different direction. This conversation quickly becomes a conversation about money. And we're going to work very hard to make it a conversation about results and money. And so I think
it... And people.
Yes. And so I think we will have sufficient information for this session. And again, our plan is to implement beginning in July.
Thank you very much.
Representative Hayden.
Co-Chair Rayfield, thank you. So I have a question on the challenges. You had a couple of bullet points there on challenges, and resource constraints is kind of a global concern, whether you're talking about education or health care or transportation, that the legislature is always faced with, and behavioral health and mental health services is something that the state has, in my opinion, struggled with for years and years and years. When do we and do we have a challenge also in prioritization rather than just, okay, globally we don't have enough money. We can't do everything. That's going to be a constant. But within that framework, do we have a concern or do we not have a concern, meaning the legislature, do we not prioritize this enough? Or is it prioritized enough and we're just not delivering good enough? And I know that's what we're talking about, but is there value in having the discussion of prioritization versus just global budget constraints?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Hayden. There is always value in having a discussion about prioritization. What it requires is knowing what you can't prioritize if you don't have the financial information you need, the human information you need, and the outcome information you need. We've prioritized in the agency for the last 2 years getting that information, and we've gotten it. And it's not perfect, but it's miles ahead of where it was 2 years ago. And I want, again, the Farley Center and University of Colorado has been a big help to us in that regard. I think we're going to bring forward a prioritization of that discussion. I have been challenged at the agency level in converting this conversation to one discussing resources and concrete outcomes in certain timelines. And I think with a lot of effort from this team and from our health systems team, we're now ready to have that conversation. It has not been the operating modality for the behavioral health discussion in the past, in part, I believe, because no one wanted to hear the answer, which would show that, for example, some areas we know right now, senior citizens with behavioral health issues are a big and growing problem in the state. We're probably underfunding that right now. We're probably not using the funds we have as effectively as we should. So we are going to bring that prioritization discussion forward. It's critical to have it. It's critical in my mind when you look at the suicide rate, for example, among adolescents in Oregon, that we have near-term solutions. The collaborative's recommendations are for the next 2 years. This isn't a 10-year plan. This isn't a 15-year plan. This is what do we do starting in July, and I expect that prioritization we will bring forward and those recommendations will force a conversation about what do we need to do in the time thereafter. I think one of the things that we know right now is there are parts of the behavioral health system in Oregon that are overspending. And consuming valuable dollars that need to be reallocated to other parts of the system that could use those dollars more effectively. And if we don't do that, one, I won't be satisfied, and two, we won't be able to manage the state budget for behavioral health. Part of what I am very focused on, and the agency is very focused on, is not leaving behavioral health, which it so often is, as a big unsolved problem that no one knows the scope of it, no one knows how much money it takes, no one knows what to do. Our goal is to bring that conversation forward to you. And we've been working very hard to get the data to do it. I don't expect people will be excited by what we bring forward. We know as a country right now, we are underfunding behavioral health. 1 in 5 children in the United States today has a serious emotional disorder. So I think the opportunity Oregon has, unlike other states, is because of the coordinated care model and the work we've done these last 2 years, we can now come forward and say, if we want to have this level of outcome for our children and our seniors, et cetera, we're going to have to invest in these interventions in this time frame, and failure to do that will produce, you know, more of the status quo. Without the work we've done in the last 2 years, we would not be able to quantify it in that way. It's critical to do that. You can't solve a problem if it's not scoped appropriately, as you well know.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Winters.
Just a quick question, because, you know, and I would agree with you, you can't solve a problem unless you scoped it. The same applies to the addiction issue and the alcohol treatment. And, you know, I'm looking at the collaboratives, and are you planning, or have you also included in the work where we are on alcohol and drug treatment? Because, you know, I look at the dual diagnosis, mm-hmm. and, you know, you can't, you know, if I'm looking at behavioral health, there's more components in there besides just, quote, the, as we tend to think as a society, just the mental side. So where are we in trying to actually do the same kind of mapping that was done and, you know, that you did on the mental health side, and also the outcome piece on the both treatment side?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Winters, spot on. The behavioral health map includes SUD issues, substance use disorders. We view both as inseparable. As you know, there's the co-occurring disorder issue, but there's also the clear understanding that many people with undiagnosed behavioral health issues are self-prescribing in effect. And I think we view it as And I do want to give the agency and the public health department as well credit for the work done on opioids this past year. But there is much more work to do in Oregon with substance use. Our numbers tell us the story pretty significantly. So we don't separate the two. We view it as one issue, and we'll be bringing forward recommendations for substance use gaps in the service continuum in Oregon as well.
Follow up. Should we also be looking at the various funding streams that in some cases do not connect together, and in a way that we're getting a better bang for the buck than what we're currently doing?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Winters, if we do this well, my expectation is that Oregon becomes expert in the financing of successful interventions and the effective consolidation of those dollars to outcomes. And there are some examples around the state already where CCOs are already doing that work in new and innovative ways. We have consolidated there used to be at the Oregon Health Authority a department called the Addictions and Mental Health, which ran parallel to the CCO system. We've consolidated our behavioral health operations in the agency, so we now look at all the money available for substance use and disorders and for behavioral health, and and how can we not just use the money we've got more effectively, but how can we draw down more?
And follow up. The other component to this, and that is the providers, because most of this is all contracted out, and whether or not you're looking at making certain that our contracts are in line and are developed in such a way that we're going to get the outcome data that we need.
Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Winters, that is going to be where I think there is a lively and energetic discussion. When we looked at our contracting authority for the health authority, one of the first things we realized as we began this quest for attaching dollars to outcomes is we have significant authority and responsibility for working with those providers to get the outcomes we want, to fund the system appropriately, and to work with them through the capacity we have to ensure that they have the data systems in place to get us what we need to ensure that we're purchasing the results we're hoping to purchase. So there's a huge amount of work there. Oregon has a number of providers. We have a number of providers in behavioral health right now who are under serious financial pressures, and part of our responsibility is to look at that and help them get to a place where they can be successful with the people they serve and generate the data that we need to contract with them. But we do have that authority currently. We just need to view it with a more energetic eye.
Yeah. Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Chair Rayfield. Director, considering that there is such a shortage of resources in a variety of different behavioral health providers, is it necessary that such a large portion of our behavioral health delivery system goes through counties, which has a very high cost of delivering these services compared to other providers such as nonprofits?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Buehler, I think we had a robust discussion of that at the collaborative, and our hope would be going forward that the return on investment for people is part of the discussion as we look at that funding. Now, I will give two counties as an example where the CCOs have initiated separating out the service continuum, so the counties do what makes sense from their funding and their scope of service, and the CCO has built capacity around that. That's one way they've gotten at that question of high cost of county services. The other obvious requirement that we have, and we have it contractually, is much of the behavioral health system, including substance use, has to operate on a 24/7 basis. It's not a 9-to-5, it's not a weekday kind of challenge. So we'll be looking at that, and the work we've done over the last 2 years to extract the financial components of Oregon's behavioral health system will help us foster good decision making.
Please continue. Thank you. Oh, yes, Senator Winters.
Thank you. Our co-chair, who's home ill, just sent me a note and wanted to know.
Me too. She's not
interested. Actually, Senator Winters, let's address this properly. Co-chair Steiner Hayward via Senator Winters, please.
The question is about outpatient treatment for substance abuse for people with past histories of felonies. And, you know, when they come out and their ability to access service and treatment and whether or not they're also falling through the crack. You know, this is the group that I think some of us are looking at, not only your sobering centers and some of the other things that are some communities are trying to establish. I know my community now is also requesting for a sobering center. You know, it's the individual who ends up in jail, but yet they need, you know, treatment and services rather than jail. And some of the behavior is behavior that...
Yes? There's a question that's...
I have... Oh, anyway, we hope you're getting better.
Co-chair Rayfield, co-chair Steiner Hayward in absentia, members of the committee, we are aware of the need for substance use treatment for felons leaving the state prison. We work closely with Director Peters to make sure those bridges are done as well as possible. I will say that, again, when you go to the approach that we're now taking, which is possible because of the size of Oregon. I have nightmares thinking about trying to use our approach in California, but in Oregon we can do it. It's a state of 4 million people. We know where people are, we know what the need is, we know how much money we have, and we know what interventions are evidence-based and results-driven. The look we're taking is how do we take what we've got and get the results we need. We will be very straightforward with you all about our bandwidth once that analysis is complete. Some work is currently being done with that population. We're told there is more work to do, and there are gaps in what's available.
Just to follow up, I was reading the note, and she's referring to the individual who, and I'm assuming that a lot of them are also homeless, that have been out of the correctional system for some time, but carry still the scarlet letter of either being a sex offender or what have you, and their ability and not being able to access treatment. So that's, I think, is her bigger question that's there. And what are we doing with respect to providing access for this particular group? So I think you could, I'll go offline and you can actually, you know, talk to her when she returns back to the camp.
Thank you.
Very good. Any final questions? All right, seeing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This time we're going to move on to a work session on a grant for our bullying detection and intervention. So we'll go ahead and open a work session, and we'll turn it over to Ms. Ames.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, OHA is here requesting permission to apply for a federal grant to support the early identification of infants with hearing loss and a system of tracking that will help ensure that they get the early intervention that they need.
Very good. Ms. Wilcox, please.
Good morning, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Wilcox. I'm the Maternal and Child Health Section Manager in the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here today to request permission to apply for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Cooperative Agreement entitled, and it's a long one, Documentation and Use of Follow-Up Diagnostic and Intervention Services Data Through the Maintenance and Enhancement of the Early Hearing Detection and Intervention Information System. Now, this is a different kind of EDI that you heard from earlier. This is Early Hearing Detection and Intervention, that form of EDI. This cooperative agreement will begin July 1st of this year, 2017, and provide up to $250,000 of federal funding per year for 3 years, ending June 30, 2020, for a total of up to $750,000. The intent of the cooperative agreement is to support the early identification of deaf and hard of hearing infants and allay potential developmental delays by implementing strategies to improve documentation of timely diagnostic follow-up and early intervention services. This cooperative agreement requires no state matching funds, and there is no federal requirement for maintenance of efforts, and there will be 42 awards nationwide. There's a current Oregon statute that created Oregon's EDI program to track and monitor hearing screening, diagnosis, and enrollment in early intervention services for children with hearing loss. The purpose of the law is to assure that infants with hearing loss are identified early and receive necessary services to prevent the delays in language acquisition, communication, social-emotional development, and to support on-time development and school readiness. The program follows an evidence-based protocol where infants are screened within 1 month of birth. Those who need it are referred for diagnostic assessment within 3 months of birth. And those who are detected with a hearing loss are referred into early intervention by 6 months of age. The EDI program provides the public health tracking to collect the hearing screening status of all newborns in Oregon, collect follow-up diagnostic evaluations for the infants who don't pass this hearing screening, collect eligibility and enrollment information for the early intervention services of hearing loss. This is file tracking the three parts of the evidence-based protocol. And report information and strategies to improve the timely diagnosis and enrollment into early intervention. Currently, there's no state general fund supporting this program. We rely on two grants, federal grants, one from the CDC, which I'm here about today, and another one from the Health Resources and Services Administration in the Department of Health and Human Services. Oregon has had this CDC grant since 2000, and it includes this one, cooperative agreement, includes both a core scope of work, which we've been working on, and a new expanded set of activities. And that's why I'm here for you today, because of these expanded new activities. The core activities enhance the monitoring capacity for us to be able to do the interoperability with the hospitals and the diagnostic folks and the early intervention folks, so we can track these children, implement training and technical assistance for our EDI partners, promote and support coordination and collaboration for tracking and monitoring, disseminate information about the incidence of hearing loss, trends, and effective strategies, and focus on continuous quality improvement. The new set of activities that will be required under this cooperative agreement are to develop protocols for use of de-identifying data, analyze and identify data errors and factors related to successful receipt of timely services, and identify methods to improve the data quality and the reporting processes. We will continue to do this work with our existing EDI staff, so no new positions will be required, and we'll continue to work with our existing and new partners in our state EDI advisory committee to achieve the grant requirements. While we can't always prevent the congenital hearing loss, we can prevent the developmental delays and promote on-time development through screening, timely diagnosis, and access to quality early intervention services. So with that, I request your approval to approve this grant. Thank you, and I'm open for questions.
Any questions? Seeing none, we'll turn it over to the shadowy CFO analyst that sits all the way to the right and rarely speaks, Mr. McDonald.
Good morning, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. Tom McDonald with the Chief Financial Office, and we recommend approval of the request.
All right, thank you. Ms. Ames.
And Mr. Chair, LFO recommends approval of the request to apply for a grant from CDC for $250,000 per year for 3 years to support the early identification of deaf and hard of hearing infants.
And with our co-chair absent today, I would entertain a motion from anyone to move the LFO recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I move the LFO recommendation. We have to send it to full joint.
Thank you very much. Senator Rudess has moved the LFO recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, motion carries. And because Co-Chair Steiner Hayward is absent today, I think it only makes sense to give her the honors to carry this to the full.
Did you hear that?
But don't make her laugh. She says she does not want to laugh.
Fair enough. With that said, we'll go ahead and close the work session. Ms. Ames, is there anything before we adjourn today?
Members of the committee, I did just want to remind you that we will have public testimony all day tomorrow. Right. And it will be on the programs we've heard today, the health systems, both the health plan and community mental health and addiction services.
Okay, and with that, we'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting. Thank you.